This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jenny Lee from the University of Arizona. It's been a while, but today we're here with Drs. Gary Liu and Deming Tao to talk about one of the most exciting books of the year, The Tokugawa World. It was published this year by Routledge. Dr. Gary Liu is a historian of early modern Japan at Tufts University, and Dr. Tao is a historian of Japanese thought who actually just retired from Kansai University in Japan. This book is probably by far the most holistic edited volume on Japan's Tokugawa period, which is roughly between 1600 and 1868. With over 60 contributors from all over the world, this book maps out how Tokugawa Japan evolved and transformed from perspectives of physical landscape, economy, art and literature, religion and thought, and education science. So welcome, Gary and Deming. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
This is such a huge volume, both in terms of the scope and the page number. Actually, it's probably the thickest book I have ever held that's about Tokugawa Japan. So how did this project begin, and what was the process of coming up with this topic, inviting all the writer contributors, and the entire editing process? What was it like?
Well, I was contacted initially by a Routledge editor and asked if I would be interested. And it is part of a massive series of the world of, or the so-and-so world, the Ottoman world, the Elizabethan world, the Melanesian world now. So it's a pretty comprehensive combination of works. And I thought, well, that's very cool. They're thinking about Tokugawa Japan as a sufficiently important unit of study that they want to commission a book on. So I thought Dumin has just said that it's the best thing that's going to appear since the Cambridge volume. So, and it's about time. It's been a generation. So the assignment was basically given to me. And then I was able to decide based on my own sense of perspectives what to specifically ask, what scholars to contact, thinking we really need to have something on Sumo, or we really need to have something on whaling, in part because there's a lot of discussion of whaling in the contemporary world. It's one of the things that people associate. Well, what's the context? So with those kinds of thoughts in mind, I contacted people, and I contacted Tao, and we thought that our combination of connections and skills would be ideal to co-edit the volume. So that's how it started.
Amazing. Dr. Tao, would you like to add anything to that?
Yes. I studied with Gary at the Osaka University with Professor Wakita Osamu, who was the leading scholar of Osaka history, as well as the Tokugawa era. Gary then was studying about the Nishiji, the silk industry in Kyoto, and I was focused on the Kaitokudo, the merchant-run Confucian Academy. So we had some exchange and became good friends. And later, I was able to got a chance to visit universities in the United States. Also did PhD at Princeton, Harvard, and then got a job which is close to Tufts University, Bridgewater State, Massachusetts. So we had a long history of personal academic contacts and French. I think this, you know, is a base for our working together to finish work.
That's amazing.
This is true. Although when we first met, I was doing urban labor in the cities, but not yet manufacture. So I wasn't quite into Nishijin. I was earlier into servants and shops, but Nishijin came later. Labor, you know, that was my main focus.
Yeah.
Oh, it sounds like it was a long time ago, which is why probably you are able to gather all the sources that you've accumulated over the years and get this massive book going. So can you talk about the structure of this book and why you decided that the book covers 11 themes? Why are these 11 themes the most important?
Actually, I think Dermin was the first to propose dividing what we had into meaningful categories. And they evolved over time because, as I mentioned in the introduction, there was more material available in some fields than in others as a result of how historiography has changed, as a result of how history itself has a history in terms of the issues that compel scholars and are currently significant. For example, I contacted quite a number of U.S. scholars about writing on peasant rebels because there was a time in which everyone was writing about peasants. In the 1970s, 80s, there was a whole slew of books. And that certainly reflects the impact of the Vietnam War. But now the issues are not so much on, peasant struggles and some other issues that were hitherto popular, but a lot on gender. So it was not difficult at all to find people to write about different aspects, gender, family, childhood. There seems to be an enormous amount of interest in the history of childhood. But essentially the way we arranged those categories was dependent on what we received. Sometimes I asked for things that were not forthcoming. I wanted something on Wasson, Edward Mathematics, although most people wouldn't be able to understand, but still it would be nice to give credit to that very distinguished scientific tradition separate. But no one would do it or had other commitments. So how did we decide on the categorization from your end, Truman?
Yes, as you wrote in the introduction, we have commissioned several articles, right? Especially on the unification in the beginning of the Tokugawa period. Mm-hmm. Also the social structure and peasants' rebellion. But I think in the book, frontispiece, there is a kind of description of this volume. Other than the history Tokugawa period, it also, there is a line called the social life and custom. I think it may be a good, description because our volume reflects the recent trends of social history in the Japanese, studies. It covers many aspects of ordinary person and life. And another thing I think is re-evaluation of sinology in the Tokugawa period. In recent decades, about two decades, actually, there's a lot of, articles in Japan to reassess sinology's impact in contemporary time, as well as after Meiji Restoration, partly beginning with a book wrote by Princeton University professor Maris Jansen, China in the Tokugawa period. And later on, actually, many, studies appeared. And because of my own background, I have many, friends in the Association of Japanese Intellectual History. I invited them to join this project.
To add on to my previous question, in these aspects, I do see some topics that are not so common, not the kind of topics you would always see in these kind of overview of the Tokugawa period or even overview of pre-modern Japan sorts of books. So when you came up with these 11 themes and the 60, more than 60 chapters on these aspects, what topics or what parts did you notice that were missing from the existing scholarships or existing introduction to early modern Japanese history?
Well, some of the topics have been covered in Japanese, so we can't say they've been entirely ignored. But for example, question of Africans, people who are described as black in Japan. Fujita Midori, who wrote a paper in here about that topic, has published in Japanese. And I accessed her work when I wrote an article years ago, Cambridge Journal, like how they received in Japan. But other than that little piece by me, there was nothing available. And I think a lot of people are simply surprised to think, what? No, why would that be? And then, of course, it has to do with the Portuguese trade and the Dutch trade. And then it, anyway, so that's what I perceived to be a gap. And I was delighted Fujita Sensei was willing to it. A lot of people are very interested in sumo without realizing that it has a history. When you do realize it has a history, you see that it goes through a period in which it is commodified like everything else. And the athletes become professional and they travel around in groups. And so one of the themes of the whole work, from my point of view, is commercialization, commodification, so many things, goods and services. And the whaling one I mentioned, I'm very happy that that hired. There's a paper on the issue of untouchable status and the applications of their labor power to different things. But that perhaps would not be in most compilations a generation. But I think in all, this reflects a different generational shift towards issues of identity, class conflict, gender issues. So some of them fall into that category. And others are just things, I thought we need to have something on manga or on the, the various types of what can be called comic books in which there's use both of text and image. So the Glenn Whaley piece, I think, is really rich.
I think he, in addition to the line I just mentioned, is called social life and custom. I think add commercial and the cultural would be a better generalization of a character of this book.
Reflecting, I think, the pool of scholars and their interests.
Actually, the book itself reflected our, personal history of in the Japanese study, as well as the connections we have had over the years. Because sometimes if you invite a scholar to write a chapter, he or she would not necessarily accept. So our friends, and we got to know in recent decades.
Harvard Reischauer Institute gatherings are useful for that. So I can be quite stationary and meet. But a lot of those invited, I've never met. Alison Tokita in New Zealand is a specialist on music, and partly because I really like shamisen and listen to it, and partly because it's so important as a popular culture instrument, whether in the brothels or on stage or in homes, bourgeois homes. Shamisen is a prism through which to look at so much cultural life. And the Confucian scholar's comments about the twang arousing erotic thoughts, it's true, but so does the electric guitar. But, that's one I wanted just because it's colorful and it rounds it out.
It was definitely
Gagaku in the reverse, in terms of upper scale of culture, Gagaku pieces. Perhaps what you'd think you'd see in a Heian while you're talking about Gagaku in the early model.
Yeah, those were some fun chapters to read. And I was very amazed that despite gathering all of this many scholars to contribute, some, like you mentioned, you haven't even met, you managed to kind of unite most of the arguments, and you have shared themes, and you have a general direction. So can you talk about some of these similarities in the arguments that were made in the chapters?
Well, from my point of view, and I'm sure that there are more things, but for me this is the most conspicuous, because I think in terms of modes of production in long duration, again, I think that what one finds here is incipient capitalism. One sees the emergence of an urban bourgeois class that sets tastes and provides markets. When you've got, as I mentioned in my article, dry goods stores that are really acquiring the characteristics of department stores in which you pay cash down without haggling like you do in a bazaar. And not only are kimono that would once have been made by closed guilds of family servicing artisans, now they're producing from workshops for the general market. Not only is silk becoming a commodity, but also the labor power of the people who produce the silk, who are being now not long-term retained by households, but rather employed on written contracts for specific periods of time. That's just, my own field of inquiry. But again, if you look at sumo, or if you look at popular entertainment, or the marketing books, or even the types of religiosity that prevail, it all reflects this market, this expanding market. And the paradox is that this is in a time when Japan is supposed to be closed off from the outside world, which would mean that it's becoming one of the more advanced countries on the planet without being a party to globalization. So there's some, contemporarily interesting puzzles to work out with reference to that example. That's just a long response to what are the themes I see, but this is one. I think that so many of the articles are acknowledging how money is increasingly mediating huge.
I think some may wonder why in the last, section, the epilogue, there are five articles, but I think it's a good, structure. Two of them actually address the collapse of Tokugawa Shogunate and the Meiji Restoration. The key persons like Yoshida Shoin and Katsu Kaishu and Yokoi Shona, as well as Shinsen Gumi in Kyoto. Another two articles actually address the issues of how the feudalism to meritocracy appeared, the tendency appeared in the Tokugawa ruling class, which speeches, samurai, and also my own article deal with the four major leaders in different periods, different areas, meaning the cultural, economic, and the political, and education, how their personal learning and education in their formative years could help them out to play a great role in the major period. So I think this volume also concerned very much about the continuity and discontinuity between the early modern and modern times.
That actually brings me to the next question, which is how do these chapters approach the problem of periodization between the so-called early modern and modern times? Because usually, at least for historians, when we talk about the Tokugawa period, it's usually referred to as early modern, whereas Meiji would be seen as the beginning of Japan's modern time. But there have been a lot of questions on this kind of clear-cut view. So how do the chapters of your book approach the question of periodization?
I'd like to say something, just to observe that there's a kind of symmetry in beginning the book with articles that explain how the early modern order, in the sense of the Pax Tokugawa, takes shape. But also beyond that, looking back to Oda Nobunaga and Toyotomi Hideyoshi, so really the early modern period, as I see it, and as many historians see, begins in 1568 with Oda Nobunaga's appearance in Kyoto soon thereafter. But the three unifiers are this transitional, and it's absolutely necessary to begin with, as we do, to look at the Tokugawa achievement, not as something that happened suddenly, but as the cumulative result of the three unifiers. And then at the end, we kind of straddle the modern. So we go from the medieval to the early modern to the modern period. That's the beauty of the Tokugawa. But we also have to look at the pre-Tokugawa aspect, the early modern period. And you see the extensive attention given to Hideyoshi and to the war in Korea. So I think there's a kind of logic in that organization. I had thought the subtitle would be After Tokugawa World, Japan 1568 to 1868, which is a nice 300 years, easy to remember, and it's true, but it's kind of jarring to see Tokugawa and then see 1568, so we knew that.
And for Dr. Tao, from your perspective of intellectual history, how would you see this book's approaching to the question of periodization?
Actually, in terms of level of synology, the Tokugawa period reached the peak of the whole Japanese history in terms of education and dissemination of Confucian scholarship. It lasted into almost up until, I think, to the Taisho period. From Taisho period, the general knowledge about synology in Japan began to decline. Some of the, extremely, sophisticated scholar, they had a family background of synology, and also they were inspired for the Chinese scholarship, contemporary Chinese scholarship, with the personal contacts with the Chinese scholars, because this was not available, before in the Tokugawa period. They could only, get knowledge from books, but not from direct personal contacts.
I think that's an important point. The book also makes the important point that there's a variegated intellectual environment. So there are factions that are deeply committed to some form of Confucianism, and among them there can be rather fierce disputes. But then there are people who reject much of Chinese scholarship because they're influenced by Dangaku or other trends. So I think, aside from emphasizing the spread of education, the spread of variety of possible articulated viewpoints, and that has something to do with the book market and the laws that allow for the pretty free circulation of literature compared with, say, France. At the same time, during the Enlightenment, you couldn't advocate atheism in Diderot's France, but you could in Japan with no problem.
And just to quickly fill our listeners who might not be familiar with the terminology here, sinology generally refers to the Chinese knowledge that was introduced to Japan during the Tokugawa period, including things like Chinese poetry, please correct me if I'm wrong, Chinese poetry, medicine, Chinese classics like analytics, the Confucianism, Taoism, and sometimes even Buddhist texts. So this is kind of the general background of sinology in the Tokugawa period. But back to our next question. So in your own research, or from your own research focus, what aspects of the Tokugawa world were you most interested in when compiling this book, even if it's beyond your own chapter?
Well, I've said something about my method of selection, which basically is explaining why I'm interested in the things that I'm interested in, why questions rise in my mind, they do. But I think I have some sensibility about what others also find interesting, perhaps even really intrinsic, such that browsing through a book like this, they might think, oh gosh, I really want to read this one. I think that we should have an approach to the past, the kind of historical interest that allows us to linger on the delightful as well as the dark, and the things that seem marginal and frivolous might actually be a prism through which to look at very serious things, like very bloodthirsty puppet dramas or, what seem to be frivolous materials. The two, not one, but two articles on Shunga. I wanted something on Shunga because it's becoming an increasingly well-researched, to say nothing of respectable, topic. I remember the days that this material was available in Modern Zen, but you'd have to go through it with a razor to cut open pages that were designed that way. Whereas now you can publish Shunga from the Tokugawa period virtually without censorship. But anyway, there's a change in the environment which allows, as the Japanese scholar in his text on Shunga points out, now people are coming to him with all these old Shunga works. They had no idea they were so valuable. They'd been kind of an embarrassment. But anyway, that's a tough addressing issues of sexuality through looking at this material and thinking, what does it mean that it is commercial item available in stores? Who is consuming it? We find it's women as well as men. It's samurai as well as commoners. That's one field I remain consistently interested in. So I'm happy that those
are. And what about you, Dr. Tao?
Okay. Yeah, actually, the book importation was part of the Sino-Japanese trading in Tokugawa period. And one of my mentors at Kansai University, Oba Osamu, was a Japan Academy awardee. Yeah. He studied the book censorship at Nagasaki. And because of that records, so he was able to know that almost about 8,000 titles of publications in the Qing dynasty, of which 80% were imported into Japan. Mm. But not only Japan was receiving the Chinese books, Japan scholars, they also had a high level of say, publication skills. Later, they found they can produce better books than Chinese, and they had the hope to do the revised exportation to China.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. So there was a dynamism between the Sino-Japanese exchange in terms of book and culture.
That's very interesting. So did they end up succeeding? Were they able to reverse the importation?
Yes, some were successful, but very few, limited through the Chinese ships, which were able to come to Nagasaki. Mm. Because Dutch and Chinese trading ships were only two, countries that were allowed to trade with Japan.
So throughout this huge project, what kind of obstacles did you run into in the creation of this book?
There are just lots of small details with the project, with any project, one of this size, involving repeated back and forth of big sections of the manuscript. At one point, there was a need to cut the length and the number of photos. So that was a lot of revision, a lot of busy work involving remove a photo, or if you include it and you have to number everything else. So no major disasters. There was no computer failure that wiped everything out. But it was surprising that a project like this takes so long. There was a point at which I thought, okay, my work is done. How naive I was. No, the work is endless until it's out. And even then, there might be things you need to change. Typos, planned paperback. It should be much more reasonably priced, not weigh like 8 pounds or whatever it is. It's like a baby.
Yeah, actually, we are so busy in this year, right? Not only teaching, but also we are, writing our own books. So,
now I can be busy with my own stuff. That's what Marx calls non-alienated labor power.
Yeah.
Labor power that I do out of joy.
Thanks to the information technology, so we can easily, get contact each other, between two of us, as well as with the editor at Routledge.
Everything is going better until your system fails and you're unable to communicate the person you see on the screen.
So I was quite curious because this volume does include a lot of scholars who are based in Japan, and I might assume these some of them were originally written in Japanese and then translated.
All of them.
So how? Yes, that's very impressive, and that's quite rare, I'd say, in edited volumes of Japanese history. So how was that process like? Was it difficult to involve Japanese scholars or to translate their works? Do you think there are things to be improved, or do you think in the future, if you were to work on another edited volume like this, you would try and include more Japanese scholars, perhaps?
I would like to include in a book on Japanese history a preponderance of Japanese scholars. Although we should recognize that an awful lot of non-Japanese are participating now in Bakugawa studies for whatever reasons they have, that might have to do more with cultural interests, might have more to do with a kind of world historical economic history perspective, looking at the unique features of Tower. The problem wasn't the number of Japanese scholars involved. The problem is the difficulty of translating from Japanese into English, period. And I've taken part in conferences in which, to prepare a subsequent conference volume, a Western scholar is paired off with a Japanese scholar with the most similar interests in order to translate. But even that, there's a skill to translating that we don't all have. So it made more sense, I thought, we both thought, to hire professional translators who are also in the field or close to. So that's what we did. And, I've been very happy with our team of five different translators. But I mean, in terms of, is there something I would do different? In this case, it wasn't clear how many Japanese we would have initially. It soon became clear we really need to have translators. We need to use part of our funds available to do that. And then we realized there was no way that the budget allotted is going to do it. So we had to around money, Loose Foundation and others, all attributed and appreciated in the rest of the book.
Yeah, of the five translators, two actually worked about 5 years before the project with me, because we founded a society for cultural interaction in East Asia in 2009 and began to publish a society journal annually from 2010. Janine Heaton actually is also teaching at my university. So she was a PhD from Stanford and working in Japan for 30 years. So she will be retiring next year. So very experienced in translation. Another, Alan Thwaites, was originally a MIT editor who is also over 70 years old and had a background in undergraduate at ICU. So had good, very good in skill in translation. Another two, I think, William Steele is a professor of ICU, mm-hmm. as well as his wife also joined the project. Robinson is also a professor of ICU. So they are all very good, scholars. Not only, translator. They themselves were scholars.
Awesome. And how about scholars of Japan or Tokugawa from other parts of the world? Were you happy with how much you were able to involve them?
I think that they basically responded to the invitation the way others did, and the whole process was the same. It was, I guess one takeaway for me is a recognition greater than I had before, vitality of Japanese studies in Australia. I think that has to do with teaching Japanese as an option in grade schools. See, they're getting really good. Let's see. We have, just looking for, Rodin Powner, is an Israeli historian who'd written a book on, I think it was originally titled White to Yellow, Japanese and the Perception of the West. And I, in manuscript form, just tore it up, actually. I'm exaggerating, but I made a whole lot of critical comments. And I was very pleased at how he integrated my comments into the final version. And I thought, maybe I'll invite him to write something on the issue of ethnic perceptions of the Japanese. But that was sort of an unexpected inclusion. Let's see, Andrew Gersel on Shunga in Tokugawa Society and Culture is one of these older British Japan scholars. Tim and Screech. I wrote a rather interesting piece on Nihonbachi as the kind of functional equivalent of a town square in Europe. Let's see. Godefroy, Naomi Godefroy from Paris, writing on Ezo. I met her at Harvard, actually, and I don't really know what's going on that much in Tokugawa stuff in general in France, but I'm pleased to find someone's deeply in a topic, into a topic. Having spent 2 years in Sapporo is kind of close to my heart. But let's see. I'm not sure if Jermin invited others than Japanese. Any Chinese? Oh, yes.
Yeah, there are two.
You can speak to inviting Taiwanese and
PRC. One Taiwanese scholar, Xu Xingqin, and another Wang Ming at Osei University. So there are two Chinese-Taiwanese people joined this project.
And I invited Xinghang.
Ah, Xinghang,
tantalizing hints of Japanese in China after the maritime prohibition. Again, taking that model and sort of challenging somewhat.
Yeah, those scholars actually sometime, some stage, we met and impressed by their work. So we invited.
Yeah, it was really amazing to see how in this huge volume you were able to involve so many, such a diverse group of scholars from all over the world, from all kinds of disciplines to write on. How the transformation and how the market grew in the Tokugawa period. So I really enjoyed most of the chapters. I haven't been able to finish it. It does have more than 60 chapters, but I will at some point. Thank you so much both for joining us today. It was an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
So how long is it going to take you to finish the whole thing? I'm just curious if I have to follow up.
On this book, I would say another 2 weeks probably.
Okay, that's
right. Yes. And that's a fair warning for our listeners who are interested in learning about every single aspect of Tokugawa Japan from one book. Make sure you check out this very thick, The Tokugawa World by Professors Dermin Tao and Gary Loop. I am Jin Yi from New Books in Japanese Studies. Stay tuned for our next episode.